Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sussi. He's a professor.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavit Atwai. Sudan's military has seized power in what is referred to as a coup. It has arrested members of the transitional government that was supposed to guide the country to democracy. What has prompted the military to seize power? And does this go against the people's will? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why the transition did not take place as planned and whether there are foreign hands at play, like maybe from the UAE, Israel, or Saudi Arabia. Let's get an idea about what is happening there in Sudan. We have Ahmed Kabaya, our correspondent from London, who joins us to tell us more about this. Ahmed, welcome. So, you know, I know you're familiar with the landscape there in Sudan. If you can tell us what is going on, and briefly, just briefly, what was agreed upon before and where the disagreements came, and maybe to what it led to what happened today.
Yes, there was a power sharing agreement, and there was a constitutional declaration that said there would be this share of power between the military and the civilian, transitional civilian government. And in that first 21 months, it was meant to be led by General Burhan, representing the military, but for the next 18 months, there was meant to be a transition where the civilian government led the Sovereign Council, which was the highest body in the land. Now, that 21 months was meant to end in November, so that's when the civilians were meant to take control of the Sovereign Council, and it seems that the military had no desire to hand over power. And this has been predictable, and some would say inevitable, because it was an uneasy relationship to begin with. This military sharing arrangement was only done as a compromise by the Sudanese people because they looked at the battle of forces on the ground and they realized the military were well equipped, well armed, and had support from some powerful neighbors, principally United Arab Emirates, principally Saudi Arabia. And it wasn't a fight that peaceful protesters could win. So they agreed to this agreement, but many people warned them that the military were just buying their time and eventually would do a coup d'etat. And today we woke up to the news to find out, today being that day, the Prime Minister has been arrested, the Minister of Information and the spokesman for the transitional government, someone that I interviewed exclusively for Press TV, he's been arrested and taken away to undisclosed location. And it seems like many more arrests are set to take place. There has been calls for civil disobedience, for general strikes, and they want to try and hurt the Sudanese economy because the people that control the Sudanese economy is the military junta, is the generals, is those associated with the army. And that's what brought about the stalemate in the first place that led to the power sharing agreement.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We appreciate it for that roundup. Ahmed Kabaya there. All right, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have editor of the Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Azikiwe, joining us from Detroit. Also joining us is African Affairs analyst Lawrence Freeman, who joins us from Baltimore, Maryland.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, I'd like to welcome you both, and I'm going to start first with you, if I may, Lawrence Freeman. We're looking at what has been referred to as a coup, and is this something that surprises you, and do you think that this so-called transitional government was not an easy merge between the civilian and the army, even though they had 18 months to try to sort things out, if there were disagreements between the two?
I was not surprised at all. In fact, I thought it could have happened sooner. The essential that when the Bush was removed, Sudan basically became a complete captive to the West, United States, British, Europe, to the International Monetary Fund, had to do what it was told in order to get so-called the debt freedom from its huge $50+ billion it owed our nation. And the problem was that prior to Bashir's overthrow, I spent those 15 years trying to convince the government to build up the economy and integrate the South into an infrastructure network of the entire nation and raise the standard of living of people. They unfortunately had a 10-year and they were overthrown, but there was no compensating policy from the West. Sudan, like many countries in sub-Saharan Africa, needs energy, it needs water, it needs rail transportation. And the West, if they were serious, would have moved in massively building these structures. The people in Sudan, I've been there many times, are poor, and if you don't address the poverty, if you don't address the lack of economic future for these people, then there will be continued unrest. And with the Biden policy supporting regime change in Ethiopia against Prime Minister Abiy, and now this coup in Sudan, the Horn of Africa has become a very dangerous place and will affect the entire continent of Africa.
Okay, let's see what Abiyomi Azikiwe thinks here. If we have Abiyomi Azikiwe with us, doesn't look like we still have him with us. Okay, no, there he is. All right, very good. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Abiyomi.
Yes, this is really not surprising considering the developments that have taken place over the last few weeks. We recall that about a week ago or so, there were demonstrations in the streets, ostensibly among people who were civilians who supported the continuation of military rule, and they wanted the dissolution of the Transitional Sovereign Council. And then on Thursday, the 21st, thousands upon thousands of people came out in Khartoum and in other cities across the country demanding an immediate civilian government. Of course, as has been mentioned before, the military controls a lot of the economic interests, the state-sponsored institutions, and also private institutions in Sudan. So they want to protect their interests, and it's going to be very interesting to see what the program is going to be, the policy of the United States towards these new developments. Mr. Feltman, who is an envoy for the Horn of Africa, visited Khartoum and met with the Foreign Affairs Minister just on Saturday, expressing concern about the problems that exist within the transitional regime. And, of course, here we are 2 days later. The military has taken over, yet there's unrest, apparently, throughout the country in response to this. The army and the militia groups called the Rapid Response Forces, the General Burhan mentioned earlier that they were actually the ones behind this seizure of power, the arrest of the interim Prime Minister, Abdallah Hamdok, as well as the Minister of Information, the Minister of Industry, and it appears that if some of the people who have been arrested are connected with Sudanese political parties, the Democratic Unionist Party and the Sudanese Congress Party. So it'll be interesting to see what the United States position is going to be on this, because they have been pushing very strongly for this government to solidarize.
Okay, lots of questions here. Let me see. Let me understand from you, Lawrence Freeman, why it is that, I think I asked this in my first question, but I'm not too sure, the military council did not was not able to agree with the civilian part of this equation, because we had 2 years ago where Burhan said, quote, the role of the military council complements the uprising and the Blessed Revolution. And he said that the TMC was committed in handing over power to the people. And even back then, however, you had protesters that said the TMC was not serious about handing over power to civilians. Our correspondent just mentioned that also, that it was not serious from day one. So why did they enter this so-called power-sharing agreement here?
The TMC, like many of these operations in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, was an artificial, uneasy coalition that wasn't going to last. Because the fact of the matter is, once you overthrow Bashir and the National Congress Party, the only thing that was left that represented any kind of national institution was the military. And that's the way the British left much of their colonies over the period of colonialism. And therefore, and the only way this transition would have worked is if the United States and other Western nations had involved themselves in massive economic development for the people. Then the people could see something was getting done. That never happened. There was a small amount of debt alleviation, but people's lives. I've walked the streets of Khartoum and Omdurman and many parts of the country. Until you provide an improvement in the material standard of living, you will have demonstration after demonstration, and government after transitional government will continue to fall. And it's the West's stupidity on not realizing that this is the central issue to provide stability. There was no stability in the TMC. There was no fundamental agreement. And regime change is never a solution in which they've been after Bashir for about 20 years to accomplish. We have to change our mindset. We have to change the way we think about Sudan and sub-Saharan Africa. And we have to involve the United States and the West in massive infrastructure, economic development to raise the standard of living of people. Until that is done, there will be no stability.
Okay, so we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and I want to dedicate this to these foreign hands that are at play. So, Abiyu Azikiwi, our guest there talks about how the U.S. failed in not providing the proper investments. It did promise it, though, and it's interesting that we have, and I'm going to bring in Israel in here, from an Israeli publication saying that Sudan was disappointed with the results of the so-called Abraham Accords, the so-called normalization of ties with Israel, and it said that there were failed economic promises by the U.S., that there was insufficient U.S. investment, and that was a complaint that Israel had said that the sources in Khartoum were talking about. What role does Israel play here? Is the U.S. investment in any shape or form connected to the so-called normalization of ties with Israel?
Clearly, it was connected. Under the Trump administration, he saw this as an achievement, a foreign policy achievement of his waning regime during 2020. Yet, despite this declaration of a, quote, normalization of relations, unquote, with the state of Israel, according to the foreign affairs minister, there has been no exchange of diplomats or other protocols between Tel Aviv and Khartoum. Also, the United States, in exchange for taking Sudan off the state sponsor of terrorism list, they had to commit themselves to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to survivors of those who were victims of terrorist attacks. And there was no specific or concrete evidence that the Sudanese government was responsible for the bombings that took place in 1998 in Tanzania and Kenya against the U.S. Embassy, or the USS Cole bombing in 2000. So these were all artificial barriers that were established, and they never delivered on any of the promises that were made. And at the same time, within Sudan itself, there are political parties and opposition groups who were totally against the normalization with Israel and other conditions that had been set by the United States. For example, to get IMF and World Bank loans. And we know over the last 40, 50 years what these economic measures have done to post-colonial Africa. They've only arrested development. They have not fostered genuine development and sovereignty. So you had several parties, including the Sudanese Communist Party and the Popular Congress Party and others, who opposed this supposed normalization of relations with Israel and other agreements that the U.S. arm-twisted Abdallah Hamdok into accepting. Now, they say he's been detained, along with other leading cabinet members. They say several people have been killed as a result of the military opening fire on people today. So the situation is very, very tense.
Okay. So let's, Lawrence Freeman, talk about money. Saudi Arabia and the UAE, they had agreed to send Sudan $3 billion. And back 2 years ago, they indicated that $750 million of that aid had actually been delivered. And $500 million was deposited in the central bank. Not bad to start out with. So you have that. And then you have the troika of Saudi Arabia, UAE, and Egypt, who supported this transition. Tell us the role that these three played, in particular the UAE and Saudi Arabia, when it comes to Sudan.
I think it's well known that even in the waning days of the Bashir administration, that the Saudis were bankrolling a good portion of the budget of Khartoum, and without the Saudis, the situation would have been even worse. But very little was done to actually improve the economy. As the previous speaker said, look, when Bashir was overthrown, and then the Trump administration said you have to then go ahead and recognize Israel as part of their Israel policy, that itself to me was clear the bell that Sudan no longer was a nation. It no longer was a sovereign nation. It was a satrapy that was going to dance to the tune of the people who control the strings in Europe and the United States and the World Bank, etc. And therefore, Sudan gained nothing from that except being taken off the terrorist list and being given relief on some loans, but nothing was done to change the country. And the Egyptians are using Sudan against Ethiopia. Sudan gains completely 110% from the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, and the Egyptians have bludgeoned and manipulated Sudan into going against Ethiopia. So Egypt is playing a poor role. Saudi Arabia is not interested in the development of the nation, and neither is the West. And this is the sad story of sub-Saharan Africa, as I work in many countries in the region. And there will be another coup. There may be a coup within the coup, like we saw with Mali earlier this year. None of this will stop, none of this will abate, and you will not have, quote, stability until you actually have an improvement for the lives of the 50 million Sudanese people who live very, very poorly. And until the West understands that and stops attacking China for actually doing these kinds of investments, I do not see a hopeful future for Sudan, and I would suggest there will be other mass protest movements and more coups and destabilizations in Sudan, and potentially, as the Biden administration is promoting, possibly in dismemberment of Ethiopia. And then you would have hundreds of millions of destitute people in the Horn of Africa.
Indeed, that looks like a crisis that is erupting here. So we are down to the one party that we have not talked about, Mr. Abiyomi Azikiwi, and that is the Sudanese people. I guess they're touched on it. What do they want? We know that they have gone out and protested against the so-called normalization of ties with Israel. But what is it that they want that they're not getting? I guess is the promise of this transition that didn't take place.
Yes, I believe the majority of the people there want a civilian government. They want to be able to operate politically and openly. And it's very interesting that General Al-Burhan, in his statement earlier today, said that he's carrying out a coup in order to continue the ideals of the December Revolution. I mean, this is absurd. I mean, the revolution was aborted by the military in April of 2019 in order to prevent a genuine popular revolution from taking place in Sudan. And then 2 months later, when people refused to leave the streets, there was a huge massacre. And the people responsible for that have never been brought to justice. And we could very well see another huge violation of human rights in the country as things are developing right now.
Very well. We're going to end it there. Thank you very much. It was fascinating information here. We had Ahmed Caballero at the top of the spotlight. And we were just listening to Abiyomi Azikiwe from Detroit. Thank you, editor of the Pan-African Newswire. And Lawrence Freeman from Baltimore spoke to us, African Affairs Analyst. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Do join us next time. For Mika Batafwe and the entire team, is goodbye. Until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, trust in respect of keeping secrets. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Trust has different forms in Islam, including faithfulness in keeping people's secrets. This is considered so important in Islam's view that disclosing a person's secret is considered as one of the capital and the major sins. If you are holding on to a secret of a believer, of a mu'min, you're not allowed to, under any circumstances, expose his secret and leak his secret. Keeping secrets in Islam is like worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you're keeping a secret of a believer mu'min or mu'mina, it is something that is considered to be a worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Unfortunately, the times we live in where too much gossip and chatter goes around, you know, we sometimes feel compelled to share pieces of information that may inculcate to be somebody's secret, some believer's secret. This is a bad habit. Sometimes we're not careful. Sometimes we just do it for, you know, to make this gathering more interesting, so we start talking about the secret of another believer. Now, in some cases, it may even end up being backbiting, right? We have to be ultra careful. If we know about, we all have deficiencies. If we know about a deficiency of a mu'min, we are supposed to keep a secret. This is who a true believer is. He hides the secrets of other believers, the deficiencies of other believers. A mu'min's heart is a safe locker for the secrets of other believers. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing trust in respect of keeping secrets. And we said it is a worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala if we keep secrets of other believers, the mu'mins. Leaking these secrets is something forbidden in Islam. Moreover, for something to count as a secret, it is not necessary that the speaker has said that it is a secret and requested that it be kept a secret. You know, sometimes we say, oh, that person never asked me to keep it a secret, so what's the point? You know, I'm just going to share it with the world or with other friends. No, you should know, you need to know that certain things, they are to be kept as secret, even if the person that secret belongs to has not explicitly asked from you. Rather, the least sign or hint is sufficient for understanding this reality. You know, when we look at some things, content, the nature of that topic, or we can tell, no, this is something that this person would like to share with the world or not. We would know. Generally speaking, we have this common sense to find out. If before speaking, somebody looks around himself to see if another person is within hearing distance, this would be adequate to give rise to the trust so that it becomes obligatory to treat when he says as a secret of a Muslim brother. Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has said, when somebody says something and looks around himself, his speech is a trust and secret, and we shall try to keep it. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around recent remarks by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who called for greater unity between Sunnis and Shias. This according to a tweet by a spokesman of the political office of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, Muhammad Naeem Wardak. He further said the Taliban are aware of the nation's enemies' scheme and work for tightening brotherhood among Afghan people.
The U.S. has always been trying to deepen the schism between Muslim sects both after the invasion and after the withdrawal. They don't stop their conspiracy, but the Islamic Emirate is aware of it and will never let the enemies of Islam reach their goals. However, they target Shias, but in fact, they are against all of us.
Afghan people have also welcomed Iran's leaders' remarks. In a conference titled Islamic Unity Week and the Responsibility of People in the Afghan capital on Tuesday, the participants said Islamic unity should be part of culture in Muslim world.
Prominent Islamic scholar and the late founder of Iran's Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Khomeini, in a very critical point of time came and named this week as Islamic Unity Week, so that all Muslims keep their unity and brotherhood. We all have the same God, Prophet, and Qibla. Then let's benefit from these mutual values for our unity and make it a culture.
Addressing the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference in the Iranian capital, Iran's leader touched on the U.S. campaign to stop sedition among Islamic countries with the help of its proxies. He said the recent unfortunate and distressing explosions at mosques targeting Muslim worshippers in Afghanistan are among such incidents that were carried out by Daesh. Earlier this month, the Daesh terrorist group conducted two deadly attacks against Shia community in Afghanistan. Following the attacks, Muslim leaders noted that such incidents are meant to divide Muslims in the war-torn country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
France's latest unemployment data showed a small improvement, but unemployment remains nearly 8%, at least officially. 5.9 million people remain unemployed, which is just a fraction less than the all-time high of 6.3 million in 2017. Back in September 2008, the total jobless numbered just 4.5 million. That means French unemployment has risen over 30% since the start of the Great Recession. With re-election just 6 months away, many say that Macron is running out of time to devote resources to the jobless or to devise a new system of accounting. Macron campaigned on a promise to bring unemployment under 7%.
His effort or his promise to increase employment by changing labor laws that would make France more attractive to foreign investors just hasn't worked. This idea of bringing in migrants for cheap labor to keep wages down is a real issue. So it's a big problem for Macron.
Under Macron's predecessor, François Hollande, the jobless rate increased 44 out of 46 months at one point. To change that, Hollande controversially started excluding part-time underemployed workers from the official count. Macron went one better and declared that just looking for work once in the past month no longer makes someone unemployed. Macron also began revealing jobless data only once every 3 months to avoid media discussion of the unpopular issue.
We have to really distinguish between what the official unemployment rate is and what the unofficial unemployment rate is. And if we take what the potential workforce is, it's much, much higher. And it's really amazing because the service sectors, like restaurants and bars and stores and stuff, can't find people to fill positions. And the reason is they don't pay enough.
For years, many French economists have said that the official unemployment rate is undercounted by a third, which would put the real unemployment rate at well over 20%. The Macron era had been one of constant economic unrest, but the coronavirus pause seems to have ended, with protests recently increasing in number and intensity. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
President
president of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Mahdi al-Mashad, has sent a stern message to the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres, slamming the world body's inaction regarding Saudi Arabia's bloody war on Yemen.
Unfortunately, Saudi money has weakened the role of the United Nations in Yemen and has changed the world body's political position. The United Nations' primary concern should be the humanitarian situation in Yemen, but it has failed to consider that.
In the message sent to Antonio Guterres on United Nations Day, Mashad called on the UN to stop manipulating the facts in Yemen for political ends. He said the world body has effectively covered up for Saudis during 7 years of war under blockade. He added that the UN failure to renew the mandate of the Human Rights Council's group of eminent experts is yet another proof of how Saudis are bribing their way through the world body.
It was not so much a message of congratulation as it was a message of blame for the UN's negative role regarding what the Yemeni people have been subjected to over the past 7 years. It's a clear message that the UN must play its role and that the international community has failed morally in Yemen. We are ready to support the continued work of the United Nations and its humanitarian organizations and facilitate their operations inside Yemen, but on the condition that the United Nations protects the Yemeni people and stops Saudi violations.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of people, including women and children, and has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Yemenis say the United Nations continues to apply double standards when dealing with the ongoing Saudi crimes against millions of Yemenis. They believe that the Yemeni army's operations are legitimate as it is defending the sovereignty of Yemen, which is the only way forward to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the country. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Small in number, but they have big voices resonating along the streets of Oldham, Manchester, calling for Israeli arms company Elbit Systems to be shut down. This is the Elbit site in Manchester, and the event here organized by several pro-Palestinian groups who accuse Elbit of providing Israel with predatory drones and other military hardware, accusing it of complicity in Israeli war crimes and in abetting Israel in terrorizing the people of Gaza. Elbit Systems UK, a subsidiary of the Israel-based company of the same name, employs over 500 people and has 10 sites in the UK, including 4 factories.
Israel is an apartheid state. It's a racist state which is preventing Palestinians from living their ordinary everyday lives. And indeed worse, it's starving them, it's bombing them, it's killing them, it's depriving them of their lands and homes. And it has been since 1948. This factory here, Elbit, is the largest private Israeli arms factory. There's 10 outlets in the UK and they are all making drones and weapons which go to kill Palestinians.
Apart from supplying Israel with weaponry, Elbit is also a major supplier of sophisticated technology to the British military.
That Britain and Israel have a clear, incestuous, revolving door type of relationship between each of their military establishments and their arms companies. We are fighting back against that here.
In August, pro-Palestine activists took their fight to another level. Direct action against the same site in Oldham, causing disruption to the firm's operations. For their actions, they often face intimidation, arrest, and possible prison time. But they say they're unfazed. Events such as the one today have led to increased public awareness about Elbit and its operations and growing calls for its closure. That, the activists say, is one important step towards a free Palestine.
The United Nations has warned that more than half of Afghanistan's 39 million population is facing acute food insecurity as hunger is rising and children are dying. "We can't feed people on promises," says the head of the World Food Program, David Beasley. He has urged world countries to step up life-saving assistance to resuscitate Afghanistan's economy.
"We have been left on the streets for 3 months now. We haven't received any aid despite calls on the United Nations. Most women and children are sick or starving. Why are they doing this to us? Aren't we human?"
job for us, but there is poverty, hunger, and disaster. We are a family of 10, and wondering what to do and how to feed them. Winter is closing in, and prices are rising. People will die if the government and other countries don't take any action.
Here, Afghan social activists have come together on behalf of millions of vulnerable people and families to protest the critical humanitarian situation in the country. They're calling on the U.S. to free Afghans' assets and compensate them for its war crimes in Afghanistan.
We're chanting for our rights. The U.S. has always treated Afghans with cruelty. Our protest today has two aims. First, we are calling on the U.S. to free up our own money and let aid flow in. Second, the U.S. must compensate us for the war crimes it has committed and the damage it has caused.
The Taliban takeover weakened an already fragile economy that was heavily dependent on foreign aid. Western countries suspended aid, and the World Bank and International Monetary Fund also halted payments. Immediate global aid is now crucial to meet the most basic humanitarian needs of Afghans as winter approaches with no jobs, cash, or prospects for the people. Afghans and humanitarian bodies have warned of imminent disaster if proper action is not taken. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iran is a land of ethnic diversity, and that is reflected in different languages, cultures, and of course, music. After over a one-year hiatus due to the coronavirus, the Iranian Folk Music Festival has once again hosted musicians from across Iran, each playing their local tunes using their indigenous instruments.
I come from the northern Khorasan province. I am so happy to be part of this music festival, to share my city's music with my fellow Iranians from other cities. I have brought a local instruments, such as sonar, which is an ancient Iranian woodwind instrument, and dhol, which is a local type of drum.
We in Sistan and Baluchistan province play sitar, which we also call tambure. We also play qaychak, which is a type of bowed lute, similar to kamanche. We usually play in celebrations.
Every night during the three-day festival, different local ensembles took to the stage to perform, so the audience could listen to Kurdish, Baluchi, Azeri, and Arabic tunes in a matter of a few hours. And this is my favorite part. On the sidelines of the festival, bands from different ethnicities get together and improvise. This is where music transcends languages and interconnects various cultures.
Music is a language that needs no translation. We may not understand each other's languages, but as you could see, different people are interacting peacefully through music.
It's so interesting to see artists from different parts of the country perform together. This is the true meaning of national unity that binds us despite our cultural differences.
Organizers say that's the main purpose of holding such an event, to unite different ethnicities through the language of music.
Music is an integral part of society's identity and history, and Iran is no exception. So the festival tries to both introduce the local music of different ethnic groups in Iran while establishing peace and friendship among them.
Organizers also hope that the festival would help revive Iran's folk music, which has long been overshadowed by some of the heavily invested genres, like pop.
Through music, it's easier to grasp the ethnic diversity in Iran, because music itself is a language, a universal language that speaks the beauty of differences and peaceful coexistence of different cultures as one nation. Yusuf Jaloni from the city of Kerman.
The sanctions by the United Nations Security Council against North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs have been in place for more than a decade. The UN now acknowledges that the U.S.-backed sanctions were at least partly responsible for North Korea's food and medicine shortages.
DPR Korea has never been more isolated from the international community than at this point in time. This is having a dramatic impact on the human rights of the people inside of the country and dampens hopes of achieving sustainable peace and security on the Korean Peninsula.
The special rapporteur was echoing and backed the call by some member states for sanctions relief for North Korea.
There must be a move back towards the spirit of multilateral cooperation that enabled the foundation of the United Nations in the first place.
This weekend, the South Korean and U.S. envoys on North Korea met in Seoul, with South Korea calling for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, and the U.S. agreeing to discuss the proposal later. The U.S. has often repeated that it's willing to meet with North Korea anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. U.S. officials have now added that the country holds no hostile intent toward North Korea, while at the same time pressing for stronger implementation of the controversial United Nations Security Council sanctions. South Koreans expressed their hope the international community could at least provide humanitarian aid.
The United Nations need to support North Koreans so that they don't continue to suffer from starvation.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has sought to build peace with North Korea, arranging summits and proposing other avenues of engagement, while the U.S. maintained a hard line. President Moon will leave office next spring. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Center for Rights and Development has released a report on casualties caused by 6 years of Saudi-led war on Yemen. The report says more than 44,000 civilians have been killed or injured since 2015 when Riyadh launched an aggression against Sana'a. Thousands of women and the children are among the victims, according to the report.
We released a report on the casualties of the Yemen war during the past 2,400 days of the conflict. 44,221 civilians were killed or injured, targeted by airstrikes and cluster bombs. More than 4,000 children and 2,800 women are among the victims who lost their lives.
Also, hundreds have been left with permanent disabilities. The report says thousands of civilian facilities were also targeted by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes. Hospitals, schools, and power stations were bombed across Yemen, affecting lives of millions of Yemenis in a country already hit hard by poverty.
The Saudi-led coalition has deliberately targeted civilian facilities to kill civilians. It did not differentiate between civilian and military targets. The coalition has violated international laws that ban military attacks on civilian facilities.
However, infrastructure are not the only civilian targets hit by Saudi and coalition warplanes. According to the report, more than 500,000 homes have been destroyed during the war. As a result, millions of Yemenis have been displaced across the country.
The ongoing Saudi war and the blockade imposed on Yemen is killing more Yemenis as it has deprived millions of civilians, including children, of their basic needs such as food and medicine. However, the international community remains silent regardless of the situation in Yemen, which the United Nations describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Human rights organizations warn that the long-term Israeli blockade has led to deterioration of water crisis in Gaza, making the enclave's water undrinkable. The organizations also said the crisis has led to poisoning of the residents of the besieged enclave. The situation was exacerbated by an acute electricity crisis that hampered the operation of water wells and sewage treatment plants, leading about 80% of Gaza's untreated sewage to be discharged into the sea, while 20% seeps into underground water.
We suffer from shortage of water. Sometimes we are without water for weeks. Meanwhile, the available water is very salty, polluted, and unfit for daily uses, especially in the refugee camps. Palestinians here are forced to buy mineral water for drinking, but only a few of them can afford having it.
Israel's attacks on Gaza last May have doubled the crisis, as the attacks pounded the enclave's already crumbling infrastructure. This presents a serious threat to the Gaza population's health, where recent data indicates that about a quarter of the diseases spread in Gaza are caused by water pollution, and a great number of deaths of young children and infants are linked to intestinal diseases related to polluted water.
Many children and elderly people are suffering from serious diseases due to the polluted water. Most of the families here go to hospitals on a weekly basis as they have kidney problems. We call on the International Human Rights Organization to support us.
The human rights groups also warn that the water crisis will lead to a catastrophe for the health system in the Gaza Strip, and called on the international community to pressurize Israel in order to guarantee Gazans' right to water security.
There are three centers for treating water in Gaza which need fuel. We can provide only 35% of the required amount of drinking water. The residents of Gaza cannot drink the water. Our underground water is also polluted and unfit for drinking, and most of the time we are forced to buy water.
Israel has deprived Palestinians of benefiting from the natural resources of water, which has led to a serious water security crisis in the Gaza Strip. The shortage of water is threatening the lives of 2 million Palestinians and has doubled the burden on the health system in the impoverished enclave. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Many of the Palestinian people displaced had sought refuge at facilities belonging to the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, which is the largest provider of aid in an area in which more than 70% of a population of some 2 million are refugees. But come summer, UNRWA chronically underfunded. Despite the renewal of aids, wanted their buildings back to run summer camps for children. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hamza Abu El Tarabish, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Displaced by Israeli Regime Aggression, Families Angry at UN Response. Stay tuned for more. At the beginning of July, Nasreen Al-Awar, 40, and her 15 children were informed they had to leave a school run by the UN in Jabalia refugee camp. Nasreen had been displaced during the Zionist regime's aggression on Gaza in May, when her house in Sudania area of northwestern Gaza suffered massive damage in one of the Israeli regime's bombing raids that month. There had been no possibility of reconstruction in the intervening period. The house remained as damaged as when she left it, and she was afraid to move back to a house that barely provided shelter for her husband, Ashraf, who is in poor health and had been chosen to stay in order to safeguard what was left of the family's home when it was bombed. But she was left with no choice. Today, she and Ashraf and their 15 children are sheltering in what remains of their home. Three walls are barely standing and the roof is full of holes. And Nasreen is angry and upset at the UN for letting her family down. My house is unlivable, Nasreen told the electronic Intifada, adding, I am afraid the walls might fall on us suddenly. were displaced during the May bombardment. Most have since returned to their homes, but in late June, for more than 8,000 people with homes totally or partially destroyed, that simply was not possible. Nasreen and her family would be safer in alternative housing than in the remnants of their home, but have no other recourse. And with the Zionist regime sealing Gaza's borders to most building materials, reconstruction of the 2,000 homes that were so damaged as to be uninhabitable has been effectively prevented. Many of the people displaced had sought refuge at facilities belonging to the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, which is the largest provider of aid in an area in which more than 70% of a population of some 2 million are refugees. But come summer, UNRWA, chronically underfunded despite the renewal of USAID, wanted the buildings back to run summer camps for children. Along with Nasreen's family, another 22 families were made to leave the school in Jabalia, while 8 families had to vacate their places at an UNRWA school in the beach refugee camp. Some received help with rent, but only according to UNRWA if their homes had been completely destroyed in May. Most had to seek shelter with relatives or return to the shells of their old homes. Still, all this might have passed as just another hardship of the extraordinarily tough living conditions in the besieged Gaza Strip, had it not been for some extremely ill-judged remarks made by one of the UNRWA senior officials that described the Israeli regime's strikes in Gaza in May as sophisticated. I have the impression there is a huge sophistication in the way the Israeli regime military struck over the 11 days. Matthias Campbell, UNRWA's director of operations in Gaza, told an Israeli TV channel on May 23rd, not long after the attack had ended. He acknowledged that more than 60 children were killed, 19 of whom went to UNRWA schools. But somehow, that suggested to him that the precision was there, even as he called the deaths of civilians unacceptable and unbearable. Unsurprisingly, his remarks went down extremely poorly, especially in Gaza. UNRWA cost-cutting measures and job reductions over the past few years, coinciding with Campbell's appointment, have come to be seen as an attempt at undermining the rights of Palestinian refugees generally. Human rights organizations, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights and the Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council issued a joint statement condemning his remarks, which they wrote completely ignored the crimes committed during the Israeli regime offensive. Angry voices online, both from Gaza and outside, denounced the UNRWA's director comments or call for his resignation, while protests were arranged in front of UNRWA's offices in Gaza that drew hundreds of people. UNRWA's director of operations in Gaza apologized for his comments, and the agency's commissioner general, Felipe Lazzarini, issued a written statement on this subject. But the damage was done. UNRWA recalled this person and his deputy to Al-Quds, where